Hey everyone, this is John, and this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is the official show for March 2016, and I am going solo. Wes and Ryan are not here, but Wes and Ryan eloped. They are very much in love, and their love is a beautiful thing, and they wanted to express their love in a legally binding way. So they are off right now, getting married, and I wasn't invited because I tell mean jokes about them when they're not here. So on this official show, we are going to, and by we, I of course mean me, we are going to talk about some news and gossip and some new releases and then preview the month of April. We might still do a book report, and by we, I of course mean Wes. Wes might still do a book report on a different show, but we'll see what he has prepared the next time we're all together and recording. We might end up posting that as its own standalone show as well. So, you know, if you're tired of his rambling, you can skip it. So let's jump right into the news and gossip. A lot of the news that occurred during this month happened at the Nintendo Direct. Already did a show covering those proceedings. So there's not too much going on here. There was a nice juicy rumor floating around for a little while. It was that Beyond Good and Evil 2 might be coming exclusively to NX. And this was a rumor originally posted by Destructoid. And it was basically kind of like a Bayonetta 2 situation where Nintendo was apparently funding the game, and that's why the game was able to be made, and that's of course why exclusivity would be implied. The really interesting about this one is they didn't get the usual sort of canned response from Ubisoft where, you know, we don't comment on rumor and speculation, blah blah blah. Ubisoft actually requested that Destructoid take the story down. So it's either true and they don't want, you know, the information out there right now, or it's so blatantly false that they just can't stand that it's up there. So really, we learned nothing. It's just a really interesting game to be coming exclusively to NX because it's a Western game, first of all, and it's not the kind of Western game that would have super broad appeal because it is sort of a niche title, but it's definitely a Western-style game that would appeal to a certain type of Western gamer and gamer in general. So that's exactly the sort of exclusive Western titles that I think Nintendo needs on the NX, not like the usual Call of Duty and Assassin's Creed and all that sort of stuff, but stuff that is very much different from things you see on other systems like Beyond Good and Evil 2, I think was what people would hope Beyond Good and Evil 2 would turn out to be. And there was another small rumor that floated around for a while about what EA was requesting or what EA was kind of requiring of Nintendo for EA to put games on their system. And they were talking about bundles with EA titles and more of a sports push on Nintendo's end for things like NFL game streaming and MLB TV and that kind of stuff, which, as someone who canceled cable a while back, the one thing I do miss about cable is live sports, and I would love to be able to get MLB TV through a Nintendo console. That sounds really awesome. So hopefully there's a little bit of truth to that. Even though I don't generally play a whole lot of sports games, I do like watching baseball, so it'd be cool to see that. Also, we got some game announcements or release date announcements. Rive is set to come out in September 2016, and this is going to be Two Tribes' last game. And this was sort of an interesting thing to announce with the announcement of their game. Basically, they wrote this big blog post about how the game is going to be coming out in September 2016, and how it is going to be their last game. They started like giving all these reasons, and I'm paraphrasing here, of course, but basically how the market became flooded with content because of the proliferation of game development and game distribution thanks to digital distribution and things like phones and Steam and the Sony and Microsoft stores and the Wii U and 3DS eShop, so on and so forth. And basically they're finding it hard to compete and keep up with the amount of games coming out, basically finding it hard to get noticed thanks to that proliferation of game distribution. And it's harder to make a more ambitious game when other companies and developers are able to get games out so quickly. I'm thinking part of this is that sort of business decision to it's hard for them to get noticed, or it's hard for them to keep up with the way games are being spun out so quickly now, so they're just going to bow out. And you know what else doesn't work? Giving up. You're not going to get noticed if you just give up. So to me, it's kind of a frustrating situation because they make games that I like, and they're not going to be doing it anymore because of games that I don't like. And to me, if you're making games and you like making games, you should do it no matter what the situation is in a business sense. You know, people should make games because they like doing it, just as I play games because I like doing that. You should consider that your art form. And when photography was invented, people didn't say, well, shit, I guess I'm not going to paint anymore. That didn't happen. They just continued to use their art form as an expression, found new ways to do it. And sure, painting's probably not as popular an art form as it used to be, but people still can be painters and make art that way. And to me, that's what you should be doing. You should be making art because that's what you care about. And forget about the lowest common denominator. Like, who cares if your game doesn't make it huge like the Farmvilles and the whatever the fuck else is popular right now? Because you do also have those success stories like Shovel Knight and like Stardew Valley and like Axiom Verge. Games that where people cared about making a good game. So it is still possible to be viable in that space. Anyway, I digress. Speaking of Axiom Verge, it did get confirmed as coming to Wii U later this year. No specific date yet, but very cool that game was going to be coming to a Nintendo system. Super Meat Boy was also finally officially confirmed as coming to Wii U, which is very cool. And Defend Your Crypt was announced for Wii U eShop and 3DS eShop. So, I'm going to take a quick break and then come back with new releases. The big new release for March was Twilight Princess HD, of course, came out on the Wii U on March the 4th. And we've talked about this game a bunch of times before. It's in the Pantheon. We try not to mention every goddamn show. But it's technically a new release, so I'm going to gush about it for a while. And man, what a game. Twilight Princess really does perfect the formula that was established way back in A Link to the Past and then continued on in Ocarina of Time. And I believe it was Jeremy Parrish in a Retronauts episode, made a remark, basically, and again, I'm paraphrasing here, basically made a remark where he said it delivers on the promise of Ocarina of Time, a promise of what a 3D Zelda could be. And what I took away from that particular comment, and I feel the same way about this game, is you get this really sprawling adventure in this big world. What Twilight Princess did that Ocarina of Time couldn't do, just based on, you know, it being the first attempt and based on the hardware that it was on, Twilight Princess really delivers on scope in a really big way. Whereas an Ocarina of Time is basically you're moving from dungeon to dungeon with not a whole lot going on in between. Twilight Princess thrusts you into this world where it feels like it's expansive and that the distances you're covering are significant. I do want to talk about a little bit in the world, because it's not really an open world game. It's definitely a more guided experience than you would typically think of as in a modern open world game. But it's interesting how it gets you into the world. Basically, instead of having this huge open field, you have these fields that are split into provinces. They split them into sections, whereas, you know, in Ocarina of Time, it's just one field. It's interesting the way they introduce you into navigating this world, because you basically have those wolf sections where you have to follow the trail. You learn a scent, and the scent is taking you to your next stop. What's happening here is it's filling in your map for you without asking you to do much in a particular section. It's like, this is your path, just chase it. And what that does is it fills in your map so you can see how everything is relating to each other once you get into the parts where you're not the wolf anymore, now you're a human Link. It's a smartly designed way of showing you how things relate to each other without asking you to wander around in a big field for a while. It's much more smartly designed than saying, hey, head in this direction and look, here's this big open area that you have to work your way through. It gives you your target and allows you to go back later and see what that area has to offer. And speaking of what areas have to offer, this game, I've always maintained, is not as empty as people claim. There's a lot going on within Hyrule Field and all the different provinces in this particular game. There's definitely not as much going on as there is in what we typically think of as an open world game. There's the cave at Kakariko Gorge, there's a cave at Elden Bridge, Lake Hylia, North Hyrule. There's two or three places you can use your spinner to get into these little nooks, a couple places where you can use your double claw shot to go down and explore different areas. There's the bird minigame, a river minigame, a chicken game, a snowboarding game. There's holes to dig in, bugs to collect, poes to collect, sword techniques to learn. There's a lot going on here. I think the problem that they try to address a little bit in the HD remake, but the problem with what people consider as emptiness in the game comes from that most of the rewards you get for going and looking in these different places are not significant. So a lot of the rewards you get are cash, which in this game, who cares? Cash in a Zelda game is hardly ever significant. They did split up heart pieces to try to give more rewards for places you can search, and they split it up to 5 pieces to make a full container, but still not quite enough to make these things memorable. There's no real side items which would make things really memorable in all of these different side places. The reward for getting all the poes is just more cash, which who cares? So that's not really super significant. The reward for getting all the bugs is, again, cash and a couple of little item upgrades. You get the item upgrade for a bigger wallet, for instance, in one of them. And like I said, you do get the stamps in the HD version, which, you know, are pretty cool. It's just like one other little collectible. What they needed in Twilight Princess was something that made it more worthwhile and more memorable. All the places, all the little things you can go into and all the little things you can find places to go in that game. Maybe if they did something kind of like Skyward Sword, where you could earn items and little trinkets to upgrade your weapons in some way, that might make it a little bit more memorable. I don't know. Clearly they weren't able to think of something, maybe didn't even cross their mind to, but I think that having some more desirable collectibles in all these places might make it more memorable and might go to prove that it's not quite as empty as some people claim. I'm going to take a sidestep over to the dungeons now, because it does take some time to get to dungeon one. It's one of the other complaints about the game, but it's not really that bad. It takes 2 hours. It's a little lengthy, but what I'm hearing a lot about in other podcasts and other comments about this game is that people are seeing that it's not really as bad. It doesn't take as long as they remember it taking to get to the dungeon. You don't spend 3 hours in Ordon Village. You actually get out of Ordon Village and then spend some time as a wolf in Hyrule Castle. So they do the tutorial section, basically, I think people are starting to see it as better paced as it was. It's still not perfectly paced. It still takes 2 hours to go to the first dungeon, which it's a long time, but it's not awful. So I do want to talk about dungeon number one for a minute, because it does set a really good tone for how the dungeons are going to be laid out for the rest of the game. So what they don't do is they don't use a lot of things like torches and kill rooms in order to progress through dungeons. It ditches those general conventions. It does so even further in Skyward Sword. Toward the end of Twilight Princess, you do get quite a few dungeon rooms that are kill rooms. But instead, what they do in Twilight Princess for the majority of the dungeons is they experiment with different ways to have you move laterally throughout these dungeons without having like the trap rooms where you can't get out until you get the key, or you need like 9 different keys in order to successfully navigate through the entire dungeon. So, for example, in dungeon number one, you are, instead of finding keys, you are finding these monkeys who are trapped in different rooms. And what those monkeys will do, you build up a collection that will allow you to access different rooms because you are able to swing on them, so on and so forth. And you encounter them really organically as you move throughout the dungeon. That's another thing that I really appreciate about the Twilight Princess dungeons, is when you get into a groove and are able to figure out rooms, they do a really great job of just kind of guiding you organically the room you're supposed to go to next. And everything flows very well in a Twilight Princess dungeon. I think the only real exception to that is probably the water dungeon, of course, which, you know, once you figure out the basic steps to how that dungeon works, you're able to get through it organically. But the first few times playing it, that requires a lot of experimentation and trial and error. So it's very different from the rest of the dungeons in that way. All of the dungeons have these sort of environmental impediments that dictate your path. So you got the gaps in the forest dungeon that you need the monkeys for, and the fire dungeon, you have the magnetic section, so you need the iron boots, which are so much more useful in Twilight Princess than they ever were in Ocarina of Time. They allow you to walk on these magnetic sections of the wall. They pull you toward magnetic sections of the wall. You, of course, can sink to the bottom of lakes. They use them as weights to weigh yourself down in those wrestling matches. So they come up with all these different ways that those things are useful to you in this game. And then, of course, I mentioned before, in the water dungeon, your big environmental hazard is those water slides. And all these dungeons really build well upon each other. They get more complex and introduce more novel ideas as you go. So, for example, you get to the Snowpeak Ruins, and basically the Snowpeak Ruins is asking the question, like, what if there was a Zelda dungeon that had a poor guide? What would that look like? So instead of it being, like, again, using all these keys to guide where you're supposed to go, you're kind of given these mini dungeons throughout this one dungeon. Like, you have a small objective, just get over to that room. And they construct these dungeons in such a genius way to where even if you tried to divert off the path, you couldn't do it because, not because you don't have like the key to go to the next section, but because the way the dungeon laid out does not afford you the ability to go to the next section until you clear the current section that you're on. And in the Snowpeak Ruins, by way of example, since I'm on that topic, they give you the cannonballs that you have to shoot out of the cannons using bombs, and there are ways to transfer them to room. That's really genius. As another example, you have the Sky Temple, and the Sky Temple asks this really interesting question about a Zelda game. It is basically asking, what if a Zelda dungeon didn't have floors? How would you navigate something like that? And I don't know if this is the sort of evolution that they took, the thought process that they took in order to come up with the idea for the double claw shot, if like the double claw shot came first or if the floorless dungeon came first. But I like to think that they asked the question, what if a dungeon didn't have floors? How would you move through it? And of course, they come up with the double claw shot in order to zip yourself from grab point to grab point. And they come up with all these different uses for it too. So of course, the Sky Temple does not have entirely floorless. It is not entirely floorless, but it has entirely floorless areas. And you have to, you know, of course, grab from grip to grip. And there are also ways to use them for like pieces that will fall away that you have to grip onto. They come up with these really cool reasons to have double claw shots. They're like the moving, not really levers, I forget what they're called. I don't think they're not pea hats either, but they're enemies that you grip onto in the air and kind of move your way around that way. They took some really interesting risks when it came to constructing the dungeons in Twilight Princess, and they tried to approach dungeons in different ways rather than your boss room is over there, how can we make this a labyrinth to get through? I mentioned the weapons, like the double claw shot. A lot of the weapons are pretty useful throughout. You know, you got your claw shot and your double claw shot, which is great. You got your bow, which they make pretty good use of from the moment you get it until the end. Bombs are, of course, always useful, and your iron boots, they made incredibly useful in the game. And then they do have the weapons that don't have a ton of uses. Weapons like the spinner, which is pretty much useful in a dungeon, and then maybe 6 or 7 spots throughout the rest of the game. You got your ball and chain, which is an even bigger offender. It's useful throughout that dungeon, and then maybe 3 or 4 spots throughout the rest of the game. And actually, I think the biggest use that I found for the ball and chain outside of the dungeon is killing re-deads, because I can make really fucking quick work of them. And then you have items that are rendered entirely useless almost immediately, like the slingshot or the lantern, which it's the lantern's not entirely useless. They do use it for like some side stuff, like, hey, you're in a cave and you can light these 2 torches and it makes a treasure chest appear, which thankfully they don't use in the main dungeon. So the lantern becomes kind of useless throughout like the main procession of the game, but for like side stuff, it does have some uses for it. If you're exploring caves, it's of course good to have your lantern and some oil so it's easier to see. So take kind of a pass on that one, but like something like the Dominion Rod, it's good for its temple and then the side quest to access the next temple, and then you never use the thing again. I kind of wish that they would come up with ways to either make these things useful throughout or maybe don't even have them at all. Like, could there have been a way to design the game without getting that slingshot at the beginning? Could they have cut the slingshot altogether? Yeah, maybe. And I kind of wish they had, because then it just becomes inventory clutter. In the HD version, they made a few tweaks to streamline the experience. You, of course, climb faster. There are less tiers of lights to collect. You also warp and transform into a wolf a little bit faster. And there are a couple of things I'm not exactly sure. I don't remember if they were in the original game. It has been probably 5 or 6 years since I played through this game. But they may have ditched a jumping statue puzzle. So you have that initial one when you first get to the Temple of Time, or you first get to the Sacred Grove, I should say, and you get the Master Sword. But then I thought I remember there being a second one right before you go into the Temple of Time dungeon, but that wasn't in the HD version. Maybe I'm misremembering the original, but if they did cut one of those from the game, I think that was a very smart choice, because the jumping statue puzzle got annoying the second time you had to do it. And then I think they might have made the second goal for the Malomart fundraising a little bit cheaper. And again, maybe I'm misremembering this, because how I always approached it in the Wii version was that, you know, you donate the 1,000 rupees to build the bridge that connects Elden Province to Hyrule Castle or Hyrule Town. Then you had this even larger goal in order to take over the store within the castle town. And how I always did this, because the levers were super annoying, I didn't know the trick the first 2 times I played the game, to just creep along the edge of the cliff, to run along the edge of the cliff in order to avoid all enemies altogether, I would go to the mart in Hyrule Castle town and pay the full price for the armor, which I couldn't do in this game. The armor was, in the HD version, the armor was more expensive than the amount of rupees I could carry. Well, actually, no, I take that back. They wouldn't even let me in the store this time around. So I managed to do the side quest carrying the hot water to the Goron first by using the trick where you just run along the cliff face. and then you pretty much avoid all enemies altogether. And then once I got the hot wire to him, I was able to donate in Malo Mart for them taking over the store in Hyrule Castle Town, and it was only 300 rupees. So this is all a very convoluted way of saying I think that it's cheaper this time around to take over that mart, which will then allow you to get the magic armor at an actual, you know, semi-reasonable price. Anyway, I digress. I'm not sure if that's different or not, but it's just something that my experience with the game this time around was different. So, I'd never played this game before with button controls. Like I said before, I played it on the Wii previously. I don't like them a lot. I think that it's much less invasive than motion controls. And there were times, I'll admit, when I was playing the Wii version that I ended up just kind of shaking the Wii remote at an enemy and hoping for the best. I think that the best part of the Wii controls was the aiming for the bow and the claw shot using the infrared sensor. The gyros on the Wii U does make aiming feel probably just as good as the Wii version. I didn't notice too much of a difference. So I do like the gyro controls for aiming in this Wii U HD version. The combat feels good without the motions. It feels less frantic. And there's a lot of cool techniques that you can pick up throughout the game. It basically gives you the Wind Waker parry attacks, but you enter them in manually, which I appreciate. It's less of a press this button real quick to win, and it makes you approach the combat in a more methodical way. It's a shame that the game doesn't require that of you. It would be nice if they threw more enemies at you more often that require you to use a certain technique or makes the game a little bit more difficult, because a lot of the enemy encounters are quite simple. It's just a matter of slashing your sword. Sometimes you have to do a stab, sometimes you have to do a vertical slash or a horizontal slash, and there are some enemies who it seems like you're required to use one of the more advanced techniques. Because they're probably entirely skippable, I understand why they don't require that you use them, but I kind of wish they had found a way to make them required to get a little bit more advanced combat into the main game. It is a shame that you can't pick up enemy weapons like you could in Wind Waker. That was one of the really cool things about Wind Waker that people really remember fondly. And I think a lot of that was also the comedy of it, seeing Toon Link pick up these weapons that are three or four times bigger than him and just see him like chuck them at enemies. But it would be really cool if you could disarm enemies and use their weapons against them. Like I mentioned before, there's not a whole lot of tough enemies throughout the game. There's a few scattered here and there, and there's no loot you can farm off of them, which is one of the other cool things about Wind Waker. But the loot wasn't really super useful, and unless they were like to do like another upgrade system, like in Skyward Sword, and you could farm loot off of enemies in order to gain materials for upgrading, I don't see how else loot could be useful in a Zelda game. But anyway, Twilight Princess is just a tremendous game. I give this the highest possible recommendation. If you've never played it, go play it immediately. If you've played it before, go play it again, even if you didn't like it the first time. Anytime someone mentions to me that they didn't like Twilight Princess, I don't go into this huge pitch like I did just now about how awesome the game is. All I say is just try playing it again and see what you think, because this game is just a really tremendous execution of the Zelda formula that I cannot possibly give it higher praise than I already have. It's tremendous. So, also out in March, we got some virtual console games on the new 3DS. Super Mario World, F-Zero, Pilot Wings, also Super Mario Kart, Earthbound, and Donkey Kong Country, all available on the new 3DS virtual console. Star Ghost came out on the Wii U eShop on the 10th. Mutant Muds Super Challenge came out on the 3DS and Wii U eShops on the 17th. Pokken Tournament came out on the Wii U on March the 18th. Mario and Sonic at the Rio Olympic Games came out on the 3DS on the same day on March 18th. Yoshi's Story came out on the Wii U Virtual Console. Hey, look at that, an N64 game. And that was just recently on the 24th. Also on the 24th, Shantae's Risky Revenge, the DSiWare game, came out on the Wii U eShop. And also Witch and Hero 2 came out on the 3DS eShop on the 24th. And then on the 25th, Hyrule Warriors Legend came out on the 3DS and the new 3DS. So that is going to close the book on new releases for March. I'm going to take one more break and then come back with a preview of April. In April 2016, we got a bunch of games to talk about coming to both the 3DS and the Wii U. On April 15th, we are getting Bravely Second End Lair on the 3DS. And this one, I played a lot of the demo, and it does a lot of the same things as Bravely Default. The battle system is essentially unchanged. And one of the best things about that battle system is finding ways to win battles efficiently. Whether it's just doing all-out attacks with all your characters or holding some characters back. It's fun to figure out. It's like a little puzzle. The best way to win battles against different enemy configurations. And they do throw in a new twist that also kind of makes you think about these things strategically. So you're not just braving everyone max out and unloading. What it does is it gives you the option of fighting a successive battle, as if the enemy is getting reinforcements. And you can never be 100% sure of what the next enemy formation is going to be, if it's going to be the same set of enemies or if they're going to mix it up based on what enemies are available in that particular area. So what this does is you win basically the first round. It'll give you the option, hey, do you want to fight more enemies? Actually, I take that back. Let me backtrack a second. Sometimes at the beginning of a battle, it'll tell you more enemies lie in wait. And if that's the case, you don't get a choice. You have to fight the next round unless you just decide to run with all your characters. And then there are some cases where it won't tell you there are enemies, but then at the end of basically, once you defeat all the current enemies, it'll say, hey, do you want to keep going and give you the option of fighting more enemies? What this does is it basically multiplies the amount of experience and job points you're getting from that particular encounter. So the more encounters you fight successively, the more your EXP and JP are going to multiply. So if you're fighting 3 and 4 rounds and clearing them out, you are going to almost double the amount of experience that you would have gotten. And it makes it really fun to figure out how best to approach a particular encounter if you have the next one in the back of your mind. So maybe you're not going to max out your Braves with all the characters. Maybe you're going to hold a couple of them back for the next round. Maybe you don't need to use any Braves at all. Maybe you're going to default a couple of times just to build up some of the points in order to use for the next round if you get one. It is also kind of fun to figure out how best to auto-battle your way through those. So it becomes another puzzle, like, okay, what if I just set my characters to this configuration? What is the best way I can get through multiple battles without having to stop and heal up in between? And then that really is the best way to grind, is to turn your encounters up all the way, which is again available in this game, and then do auto battles with an effective setup. Even though you're kind of stepping away from having direct agency over the battle, it is nice that they have the option of doing this grinding, which I assume will be necessary in the game, while doing something else. It would be nice if they found a way to balance the game to where grinding wasn't necessary and you didn't have to do something like this, but at least they give you a way around it, I suppose. There are a couple of new classes in the demo to mess around with. You have the Astrologian, basically doing stat buffs, and you have a wizard, which is an interesting class because you are adding magical attacks, or sorry, you're adding attributes to your magical attacks. So basically, you have a fire attack. The two different options they had in the demo is you could add like darts to it or hammer to it. And what hammer will do is it'll turn your magical attack into a physical attack using that element, which is pretty useful. And what dart will do is it will basically give it like a top priority, like that will happen first, which is kind of cool. And then there's also, I forget what the class is called, and I don't have it in my notes. It's like a gunslinger, like a Western cowboy kind of class. And I haven't experimented with that two class a whole heck of a lot yet, but it does seem to be a pretty powerful physical attacking class. So looking forward to using that one a little bit more. And then in the demo, you have some returning classes. Your Swordmaster, your Valkyrie, Performer, Red Mage. Red Mage job skills for everyone is almost downright necessary because it is the only way you're going to be able to heal up unless you decide to carry all these potions with you, which, you know, who the fuck wants to do that? But yeah, Bravely Second is turning out to be a pretty solid game and one that I'm definitely looking forward to getting in a few weeks here. Also coming out on the 3DS on April the 19th is Landgrisser Reincarnation. And this one is another strategy RPG, which it feels like we're getting a ton of recently. And really the only ones that quickly come to mind are Stella Glow and the Fire Emblems, which there are three. So that's probably why I'm feeling the overload of strategy RPGs at this point. And I watched a little bit of this game. It seems a bit rudimentary. I might try it one day, but this is definitely one that's going on the back burner behind ones like all of the Fire Emblems, and I still need to finish up Stella Glow as well. So I have heard that it mixes some sci-fi elements with the really heavy fantasy aesthetic, which could be cool. It'd be nice to get a non-fantasy strategy RPG or RPG in general on the DS, because a lot of them do have like a really high fantasy aesthetic, which it would be nice to break away from that for a little bit. Coming to the Wii U on April the 22nd, Star Fox Zero, which has been the subject of a lot of discussion recently, pretty much ever since it was shown at the E3 this past year. So there are some things that I want from this game. I don't know if we're getting quite yet. I'm okay with trying motion controls, but I do want them to be non-intrusive, which hopefully turns out to be the case. Doesn't seem to be the case right now. It's not a deal breaker, but you know, an option for less involved motion controls would be really nice. Maybe the motion controls will work really well for me. I'm going to try it and find out. One thing that I also want is, and this is tough to describe, but basically kind of a permanent world map. So, for example, in Star Fox or Star Fox 64, anytime you start up the single player, you basically have to start from the beginning, and any routes that you have previously opened up disappear, and you just move through the game linearly. What I would like to see is basically a world map of the sector of space that you're in, the planets that you're moving through, and any secret routes that you unlock remain permanently open. So any areas that you have previously opened up, you can just skip around to. And it'd be really fun to just kind of go through and find all of the secret areas and alternate routes and just be able to see all of your progress on one screen. That's what I'm really looking for in a game like this, because if it's just play from start to finish, you know, I'll do it. I might do it a couple of times, but I don't know how hard I'm going to look for secret routes if I don't permanently have that progress displayed for me. But in Star Fox Zero, every time they show it, it looks a little bit better, and it looks like it's coming together. You know, motion controls being a little bit questionable notwithstanding, They did recently announce some amiibo support. So they've talked previously about the Star Fox amiibo and how it unlocks the Super Nintendo Classic R-Wing. The Falco amiibo will unlock a black R-Wing, which looks very cool. And basically, it will allow you to lock on to a couple of different targets, but it also takes triple damage. So it's kind of giving you a hard mode there, which is very cool. Star Fox Guard is also coming to the Wii U on the same day. It comes packaged with the game, or you can get it digitally for $15 if for some reason you just want to play Star Fox Guard but not Star Fox Zero. But as it is packaged with the game, it's a nice little bonus. And it looks like a fun little twist on Tower Defense. I did talk about this one back after the Nintendo Direct, gave a few thoughts and had a few questions about the game, which I don't think we've learned anything quite yet. So basically, what I would like to figure out, or what I'm looking forward to figuring out about this game is, you know, are there going to be different types of guns that you can use? One of the questions that I had about the game is, will you be firing automatically, or will there be some sort of manual gunplay going on? And it seems to be manual, but because they're turrets, it doesn't seem to be a whole lot of different ways you can shoot. You're basically like shooting directly in front of you where the camera is pointing. I'm also wondering how leveling up will affect the performance of your guns, if at all. Will there be different types of guns? In the video that they have available, it's showing pretty much just a laser. Will there be things like bullets or missiles or things that will require ammunition, which will bring resource management into the mix? We'll see. I'm looking forward to trying this one as well and figuring out all of the nuances of the game. Sega 3D Classics is coming to the 3DS on April the 26th, and this package includes Power Drift, Puyo Puyo, Maze Walker, Fantasy Zone 2, Sonic the Hedgehog, Thunderblade, Galaxy Force 2, and Altered Beast. And they always do a good job with the production value of their classics. It's a shame that Sega doesn't make more games and a bigger variety of games, because they used to be so good at it. And it's just disheartening that the highest profile stuff they put out now is Sonic or classic collections. I'd really like to see them get back to making the types of games that they did back when they were huge. And finally, Lost Reavers is coming to the Wii U eShop on April the 28th. I believe there is a beta on the 14th, but the full version will be available to everyone to download for free on the 28th. And in this game, they really haven't shown much in the way of variety to the environments. It's pretty much just this deserty sort of tomb, kind of what you would imagine the inside of a pyramid would look like, which is a bit of a bummer. I would like to see a little bit more variety to the locations you are moving through. Maybe that will be the case. Maybe not. We'll see. But I think that the fun in this game is not going to be from moving around in the environments. It's going to be just from the mindless co-op carnage. And a lot of that is going to hinge on how does the combat feel. Is it going to be satisfying to go around hacking your way through enemies, or is it just going to feel repetitive? Also, what is upgrading going to do to your weapons? Is it going to feel enough like the game is evolving through these upgrades? Because it probably won't be any actual evolution to the combat or the gameplay, but if they make upgrading your weapons and becoming more powerful easy and rewarding, that could be enough to keep it fresh for long enough to play for a few matches before moving on to something else. So again, this could be, it has the potential to be a fun like little Left 4 Dead kind of game where it's not deep, but it's entertaining enough to play for a little bit. And if they keep those upgrades coming fast and hard, it could be fun enough to keep me coming back a few times. But those are the games for April. And that is going to close out the official show here. So in about a week, we're going to be back. The three of us will be back for the Pokemon show. And we'll probably have a couple of Space World episodes in between now and then. But we are going to be talking about, there's been a lot of Pokemon Go news, which I held off on talking about on this show so that we can talk about it on the Pokemon show. And we're going to be wrapping up our Gen 3 draft run through, and then maybe even talking a little bit more about the Gen 1 Virtual Console games, and of course playing Who's That Pokemon. So that's going to be a packed show. Then we'll move over to the mini show and the Super Nintendo show and close it all out in the month of April with another official show. So until next time, everybody.